I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. Trump's victory in the elections has predictably led many who oppose him to consider leaving the United States. It's now a meme, really. But two nonprofit executives did leave the U.S. in 2020 as the Trump administration, the country, and the world were reeling from the COVID pandemic. After all, there was no work to go to, and you could work remotely from anywhere. Once they found a way to make it work, they have spent the last 4 years building a new kind of life in Jamaica. And just in time for this election, they wrote a book, We Quit America, Our Exit from a Country Designed to Kill Black People, thinking it would be a resource for those disillusioned with and alienated from the American political and economic system. Authors Yannick Redwood and Ronnie Galvin join me to explain their book and lay bare their inner thinking about the choices they have made. Some Montgomery County folks might recall Ronnie Galvin's work in Silver Spring trying to address structural racism. The show notes have a link to their website where you can buy the book. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Really, really neutral, yeah. Music for this episode comes from the Washington, D.C. rock and roll band Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloos on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutro and Juniper.
Tell you I'm neutral. Uh-oh. I'm really, really neutral. Yeah. Uh-oh. I'm neutral. Yeah.
Uh-oh. Yannick Redwood, Ronnie Galvin, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A central argument in your new book, We Quit America, is that Black people should leave the United States, no matter if Kamala Harris had won. Now that Trump has won, are you actually getting a bigger response?
We wrote this book in this moment because we knew that if Trump won, and he did, but this is in past tense, we knew that people would be looking for answers to the question, can I leave America or where can I go, right? It happened in 2016. And so we wanted people to have a resource as they are grappling with that question. And not a resource in the sense of like, well, you know, What do you do about visa applications or which country should I choose? Or, you know, those kinds of logistics. That's not what this book is. This book is about a way of thinking about yourself as an American moving out into different places in the world and the kinds of things that we think that you should be thinking about when you make those moves. And so there are certain places, we talk about it in the book, where lots of Americans go and it ends up driving up prices in a local community and making it impossible for locals to afford to live in that community. We wanted people to have a framework for how to be, how to not carry the American, some of the kind of ugly American ways of being out into other places in the world.
You wrote the book anticipating a Trump victory, but it is outcome neutral between Trump and Harris.
It's not anticipation of a Trump victory. It's the anticipation that people will be so fearful under a victory, they will start looking for other options. And those other options include leaving the country. And at a time when people are looking at that seriously, we have something to say, especially and only really to Black people who are trying to make these decisions.
We're talking about systems and structure. And the system and structure, one of them is racism. It's white supremacy. It's patriarchy. Like, all of those are systems and structures that actually feed the ultimate system, which is racial capitalism. And so what one group of folks, I think, is saying is that they believe, they want to believe, people of color, white folks certainly want to believe this. And I saw this firsthand in Montgomery County when I was doing my work there, that we live in a colorblind society. Can we stop, please, talking about issues of race and difference and things of the like? And so rather than actually deal with that reality and accept it, they said that no longer is a part of our algorithm. And so they've divested from that. And so that's an analysis question. It really is. And we fundamentally disagree. We fundamentally disagree. We believe that issues of race and class, racism, genderism, classism, they are baked into the design of this system. And that Black people in particular struggle the most outside of our indigenous sisters and brothers.
One of the most profound parts of the book is about the costs we pay to be well off. In order not to pay those costs, we have to give up the pursuit of wealth itself. To what extent do you think you have achieved that part?
Achieving. We are working really hard to undo what we have been socialized into, to accumulate and to save up for fear of what might happen in the future. And so these are questions that we are in. It feels, Ronnie, like we're in these questions daily. One major question is about retirement. The narrative is you work your whole life, and so that you don't become destitute toward the end of your life. If you're middle class, I mean, they're talking $1 million you have to have put away in your account. And we bought into that. And we've been working and saving to put that money away. And we still have many working years ahead of us. I mean, it's not like I'm 49. Ronnie's a little older. but I'm 49. And so I supposedly am working till I'm 65 at least. And as we made this move to get out of the country, one of the things we gave up was saving for retirement. And it is a frightening thing to consider, not putting away money so that when you stop working, you're not going to be without the resources that you need. But we couldn't make the math work to like build somewhere else while still saving up money in America or in our retirement accounts for the future. So it's something that we're grappling with daily.
Apart from retirement, where else are you giving up this pursuit?
Quitting first starts in your consciousness. That's the first place where quitting starts. This idea of demythologizing the American empire, right? All the things that that is a part of the messaging and the PR machine, right? Including like wealth, right? Demythologizing wealth. If wealth is only defined in financial terms, that also is a problem. Our income has dropped precipitously. By the way, we're living a much better life now with less income. And that was a choice. In the American political economic context, work is central. Work is no longer central in our lives. Our marriage is central. Our family is central. Our community is central. Our health is central. One of the things that we used to do when we first got to the island, so we were getting Amazon packages two or three times a week. And we said, wait a minute, that's not the kind of quitting we talked about. And so we had to actually flip our brains and say, there's just going to be some stuff that we are going to do without because we can't actually feed the system that is killing us. Now, mind you, we still feed that system in many ways now. But as Unique said, we are decoupling the best way we can. Think of it as a complex, messy divorce. That's what it is. And so we're decoupling slowly but surely.
I was wondering when he was going to say income, because that is the thing that is just so radically different now. And for me, especially, has been very difficult. I have lots of issues around money and stability of income, and to make the decision to say, okay, we are no longer full-time employees, right? So during the pandemic, we moved to Jamaica, working remotely. Okay, so cool. You can still keep your income, your flow going. And then when it was time to go back, when people were saying it's time to get back to the office, and Ronnie and I looked at each other and was like, if we don't pivot now, we are not going to make it out. If we don't make some hard decisions right now, we will go back into that system and we'll probably never leave in the way that we had thought about leaving. And so one of those things was to say, we are moving to contract work. We are doing consulting work, part-time, very part-time. Ronnie, for you, it might, I don't know, you may feel more comfortable, but for me, it's a daily, like, okay, I understand why I'm doing this. I have to talk through to myself that this is a better way. It's hard. But what we say in the book is that it's all hard. All of it's hard, right? Living in America with all the money and the rat race is hard. Living on an island where you have less money and less access to all the comforts is hard. We are choosing that hard.
Now, in the book, you are transparent about your incomes and where they were, where they are now. I'd argue somewhat painfully so. When you left, you were making $445,000 between the two of you. And I understand that you say that wealth or education is not a protection for Black people in America, and I agree with you. But, you know, $445,000 puts you squarely in that 1%. And, you know, you obviously have shifted from there. But that base of income and the concomitant, if you will, retirement savings. You may not have $3 million, but you certainly have $1 million by then. So that capital accumulation that you already did, to what extent is that able to do the things that you actually chose to do? That, you know, somebody in there, I was looking at the various people you interviewed at the back of the book, and generally they tend to be in the 40, 55 category. Age-wise, I would stake from that means a bunch of resources that they have accumulated themselves. So to what extent does quitting require a base of resources?
The way people migrate, not just Black people, all people migrate. Someone who has an extra resource will go, and then they will bring their brother. And then before you know it, you know, a few more people from that community have moved, and that's how people move. Somebody moves first, and then other people start to move. And I think about Devante's story in the book, that he felt that he would be living under a bridge if he remained in the United States. I believe he was a home health aide or something like that. And he was.
And he moved to Mexico, right?
Right.
His mother had already moved there a couple of years back. He called her. He's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And she says, come here. And this is a pattern. This is how people move. And so I think there are some circumstances like ours where we have some resources to be able to make them move. But I don't think that's how everyone needs to move. I think that there are people who can make this move because somebody else has done it. Right? So we've made the move. My mother came to live with us. And we've been trying to get others to, hey, come, we've got land, right? Come here. You can find a safe place here. And Ronnie always says that if we can start to build more of these places around the globe, that people, even those with fewer resources, can also come. Ronnie, you say it better than me about the kind of new underground railroad.
Yeah. I mean, I'm reminded of the Great Migration, where Black folks in the South were fleeing racial violence, lynchings, and things of the like. And it took some group of people fleeing from danger to actually set up hubs around the country. And now, you know, places like Chicago, Detroit, even like LA ended up being one of those places. That's the kind of infrastructure we hope to use. We certainly, from an education standpoint, our professional careers, and the access to income that we had, we were able to organize our resources so that we can get out. We could get out physically. But what our hope is, and we write about this in the book, is that folks who have the resources to get out would be committed to building these kinds of places and infrastructure so that if and when the danger actually gets so acute and heated that those who are lesser privileged are trying to get out, we have already made the way easy. And that is a generation or two project. What we discovered when we wrote the book is that people have already been building it. And Unique and I are just catching up on the 1%. On paper, we were a part of the 1%. But I just want to say, and you won't be surprised by this, Black people's 1% is different from white people's 1%. So Unique's working at a big foundation. I'm working at a nonprofit as executive director there in Montgomery County. We thought we had a house in Atlanta. We had money in the bank. We thought we were doing something. And I don't know who said, hey, you need to talk to my financial advisor. They can kind of get you hooked up. We said, okay, great. We called the guy up. He said, send me your stuff. We sent our stuff to him. We got on the phone. I don't even know if we made it to the phone. Did we make it to the phone?
Yeah, we did.
And he said, well, I don't think this is going to be a good match. And we were like, why? He says, y'all don't have enough money. Right? And so Black people may have income and some wealth, but generally speaking, like, that wealth pales in comparison to white wealth, certainly. And usually we're spreading that wealth around. It's not sitting in a bank somewhere, right? Because our networks, because of racial capitalism and the power of extraction, creates all kinds of stressors on our families and communities. And so we're generally sharing that wealth more than it's just sitting in the bank.
Tell me about your family. Tell me where your children are. Are they considering moving out as well? Their parents wrote this book. They have laid out a path. So from their perspective, how do they see quitting America?
Our daughter would probably say that we've been trying to convince her to make the transition. And she's been saying, maybe, but not yet. We are in a rural community on a hill. In Montego Bay, above Montego Bay. it makes sense for us, you know, 40s, 50s. I don't know if it makes sense for her to be in Jamaica.
I take it you're saying that she's single.
Yes, she is. Maybe another place. You know, maybe there's another town with more going on, but where we live in the rural part, it, you know, may not be her cup of tea.
Our daughter has quit consciously. I think she has a very clear analysis of what the American empire is designed to do and produce and who it's designed to privilege. She has a very clear, and so there's certain moves that she makes, even when she's in DC, for example, that makes it clear to me that she's divesting already from like what is supposed to be the kind of traditional professional career, so on and so forth. So I would say that our son, even with all of his challenges, I think what he has rejected is Black middle class. He's rejected the performity that comes with Black middle class life, respectability politics. I think he kind of got a glimpse at, and I think many Black children got a glimpse at their parents working, grinding, coming home after work, listening to us talk about our bosses and all of our, like, and I think they were listening. They said, I don't really want that. So I actually think that even though they're not physically here like us, I think both of the young people in our family have an analysis of the country that I would put in the tradition and in line of quitting.
What other connections do you maintain with the United States?
I think the main connection would be to work. So our contract work is with US-based organizations. We are trying to figure out what other way there is to work, maybe globally. Maybe there's something else that we can be doing that doesn't require us to make income from US-based organizations. But we're still very early in thinking about that. We have been divesting. So our first home we sold in order to be able to make this move. We do have a small condo that we were living in Washington, D.C. We've been trying to get rid of it and haven't been able to.
You did mention healthcare, though. You have doctors here.
We have doctors in the U.S., but we also have doctors in Jamaica.
But your prescriptions are here.
Some of them are in the U.S. Some of them are in Jamaica. I just called because I needed to get some biopsy done. The doctor couldn't see me for several months. I just said, you know what, I'm just going to do it in Jamaica. So we're in between. We're in this in-between phase. So even though the book says we quit America, which sounds like past tense, it's done. It is a process. It'll be that way probably for forever.
There's a place in the book where this exact issue is there. Can you take the American out of you?
Yeah, someone asked me that. You can't quit America. America's in you. It took my breath away.
I disagree. I do. I disagree. I mean, I know that I was born in America, but when I came to my own consciousness, there was another identity that transplanted, in my mind, the American identity that I was born into. And there are two, actually. One is I'm an African. I am a part of an African diaspora. I just happen to be born in America, right? And the other one, and you'll appreciate this because you always call me Reverend, right, is I'm also a child of God, right? And so now, and I will go back to the, I don't know if it's an analogy or a metaphor, but like we're in a messy divorce, but I'm not married to the United States anymore. I don't expect to be wrestling with this for my whole life. And I mean, I have some folks, unique, they're folks in your family who've relocated to Ethiopia. They've never been back.
My family members who left, went to Ethiopia, they had never been as close to America and to consumerism and all of the things that we have been socialized into. And so I think the move was easier for them So we were really close to all of the things that America stands for. And so, you know, I disagree. I do think we will be wrestling with this for a very long time because of how close we were to middle classness and income and hoarding wealth and all of that. I do think it'll take time.
Does it make a difference where you go? So there is this issue, I think, in the book that you talk about is going to a black majority country. But there are people in the back of the book, in the last chapter, where you interview a lot of people. Some of them are not in black majority countries, but living, you know, still very fulfilling lives. They quit America, went to some other place. So what is your thinking about where to go?
I don't know if you saw the movie Get Out. That's really the first order of business. Consciously get out. If like things really go sideways here in the next 4, 8, 12 years, folks will really need to get out. And so at that point, it's like get somewhere that's safer than where you are. Getting out is like the first order of business, consciously and then if necessary, physically. We do have a preference. We invite people to consider moving to a country where Black people are in the majority.
We do think that the American narrative, someone at a book talk said so seductive, that for people to like think beyond that is it's like that's a lot to ask. And so if there is a push, and there has been, this election is one of those pushes, and there's an opening, then this is the time where people can explore other options. There are actually really beautiful, amazing places around the world where people live differently, have different values, different cultural norms that are aligned with how they want to live their lives. And so I just think that this is it's an opportunity. It's a moment in time that is an opportunity to like bust through that American narrative that says that the only place that you will be safe, the only place that you will be comfortable is within the borders of the United States.
I know your book is not aimed at me. I came to the United States. I chose to come to the United States. I'm a first generation immigrant, seduced by the very narrative that you want to leave behind. What do you say to me?
I would first ask a question. Is it working for you? And if it's working for you, we want to be very empathetic. We want to be very careful, right? So there is a woman who has come to a couple of our talks who is from, is it Kenya? She said she left Kenya to come to the United States for opportunity, for economic opportunity. She will not go back to Kenya. And to that we say, if it is working for you, then those are choices that we honor. We honor Black people's choices. We honor people of color who feel like they need to come for opportunity. We are really talking to people who for whom this is not working.
Martin Luther King is mentioned in your book in passing. From the perspective of someone like me that came to the United States with an integrationist dream, do you think that dream itself is dead?
That is such a hard question because it is about people's dream. It's about people's wanting a better life for themselves and their families. And I never want to say that someone's, some community, some people's dream is dead.
But if you're a friend of mine and my dream is dead, is it not incumbent on you to show me that?
Is the dream of integration dead? It was never alive. That would be the heart truth that I would say to my friend. I would say to you that whatever your dream is, it's probably not possible in this context, because this system was not designed to produce the kind of integration that you're probably dreaming about. America's version of integration, and I saw this up close and personal in Montgomery County. And by the way, I think the Democratic Party is grappling with this right now. They've been grappling with this for years. America's version of integration always has to have whiteness at the center. Until that somehow is exorcised, and I don't believe it's possible, I believe it is baked into the foundation structure, infrastructure, social contracts, ethos of the country. But until that is actually removed or excised from the structure of the country, you will never have the integration that you're dreaming.
I think, though, there is still something really valuable about dreaming and hoping. There's still something very valuable about that. And maybe you can wish for that, dream for that, and build it in other ways. Are there ways to create like little experiments that will eventually crowd out the current ways in which society is ordered? And I think that comes from dreaming. So I wouldn't want to tell my friend to never dream or hope for that. Because if we don't have something to like inspire us to like create and create new ways of being and create these experiments, then I think we're all done.
Y'all have a dream as well. And that dream is to quit America, go someplace, be free of a society that kills you. And yet you are still part of a global capitalist system. To what extent is that dream impossible?
I don't think that that's our dream. Our dream is for Black people to find freedom and liberation in all aspects of our lives. Our strategy or tactic to leave, to save ourselves, to build somewhere else, to be in solidarity with Black people no matter where they are on the globe, I wouldn't call that the dream. That's a strategy. The dream is for Black people to experience freedom.
Despite your strategy of, you know, cutting yourself out of a racially hierarchical capitalist system that now, for better or for worse, is global, with Jamaica certainly part of it, what is the possibility that you can actually do it? I mean, there are so many tentacles we talked about that you maintain and have to maintain in order to have the life that you want, that the high cost of cutting all of that is maybe not worth it. So in a sense, that dream, not maybe strategy, is an impossible one.
I agree with Yannick that our dream is freedom, is liberation, it's safety, it's being able to breathe. And you're right. Just like the whiteness that I think jeopardizes the integration dream in the United States, capitalism also, racial capitalism also jeopardizes the dream of Black freedom, Black liberation, Black breathing globally. That's absolutely true. And we might discover that it's impossible. Nobody's told us that yet. What we know is that it's not possible in the United States by its very design. And so we're willing to take that risk. We're willing to have a precipitous drop in our income. We're willing to decenter work. We're willing to actually not be in as close proximity to our families and friends. because we believe it's worth the risk and that the gain is much more than what we might perceive.
Yannick Redwood, Ronnie Galvin, thank you for taking the time to join the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
That was Yannick Redwood and Ronnie Galvin, authors of a new book, We Quit America, Our Exit from a Country Designed to Kill Black People. In the show notes, you can find the link to their website where you can buy the book. In March 2023, I did an episode called To Look for America, where I interviewed former Wall Street Journal reporter Neil King Jr., who had walked from Washington, D.C. to New York City in the spring of 2021, and wrote a book called American Ramble, A Walk of Memory and Renewal. King is white and male, tall and spiry, and I had asked him how those characteristics allowed him to belong where he went. He had written eloquently in his book about how belonging depended on simply becoming a part of where he was. He acknowledged his privilege. I am still hoping one day to be able to drive coast to coast, which I have not done in my nearly 30 years in America, just to be able to see the land like Neil King did. I suspect, however, I am headed into a period of romantic correction about how welcoming the United States is and whether a coast-to-coast drive like the one I am imagining in my head may be feasible now. I hold out hope one day. I'd love to hear from you about your romance with America, whatever state it might be in currently, alive or withering. To talk back to the show, record on your phone and email the file to producer at ihppod.org. We'll play it on the air. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, and assistant producer, Adama Gay, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from Washington, D.C. rock and roll band, Seven Door Sedan. Glenn Kowalski on vocals and guitar, Josh Singer on bass guitar, and Norman Vandersloos on drums. You can find their newest fall 2024 singles on Bandcamp. We use two songs, Neutral and Juniper. If you want to share your music on the show or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time. She's watching TV. She's looking at me, old Juniper. She's watching TV. Juniper, Juniper.